dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has not only considerable native intelligence, but actually has practiced the tradecraft of it for the Department of Public Safety in his state of Texas, is our first guest. He is Todd Benzman. He is a remarkable resource, a former investigative journalist who brings those skill sets to bear as well. In his present capacity as the National Security Fellow for a wonderful organization, the Center for Immigration Studies, he is the author of a terrific best-selling new book, America's Covert Border War, the Untold Story of the Nation's Battle to Prevent Jihadist Infiltration. Todd, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
I know you've just returned from south of the border, and you've been doing, as usual, some intrepid investigative reporting and analysis there. You have a new piece up at the Center for Immigration Studies website, cis.org. Tell us about Catch and Bus.
Catch and bus is a phenomenon that is underway across the country, across the border, where immigrants who would be, we would have called them beneficiaries of catch and release, are being waved through the turnstile and onto buses. I call it catch and bus because, by my estimation, about 30,000 of these immigrants fresh off the river or right over the border are being put onto buses and transported to Indiana, New Jersey, Florida, California, you name it, Detroit, big cities across the country in an ongoing conveyor belt, a pipeline of people moving throughout the country right off the border. And while there's only 30,000 at this point, that's just from the first 2 or 3 months of it. And I anticipate that those numbers will reach really astounding highs as we go on through the border crisis.
And why wouldn't they? There's seemingly no reason for people who are willing to risk everything to get here to refrain from doing so if they're treated in this fashion.
Well, it's self-propelling. I mean, what happens is that, you know, every one of these immigrants, I mean, I've been on the buses, photographed and videotaped them. You could see all that on my piece at cis.org. Once they're on the bus, they're communicating with friends and family still south of the border saying, I'm on the bus, I'm in. So that, of course, propels ever more illegal immigration over the border. And these are leniency policies that the Biden administration has put in. We're never going to send children back and that sort of thing.
Well, we've been talking about this with you, you know, since before the election. You warned then, and you certainly have been vindicated about the so-called Biden effect that would be predictably had on such individuals, calculating that Joe Biden, his administration, is going to accommodate them and is certainly doing so now in a big way. Todd, you know, I think for many of us, the question keeps recurring, why is the Biden team doing this? And when you talk about disseminating these individuals, families or, you know, onesies and twosies, but in vast numbers through every corner of this country, the theory that I have keeps cropping back up. This is about changing the demographics. This is about changing, ultimately, the electorate of the United States. Is that at odds with your own assessment?
I mean, I don't disagree with that. I do believe that many of the folks that are being bussed in under catch and bus are probably going to vote Democrat when or if they ever become citizens who can vote, or, you know, maybe they might figure out some way to get them vote.
Yeah. If this H.R. 1 legislation is enacted, a lot of those people are going to be put immediately on rolls that could give them access to voter registration cards. And we find that not infrequently, they wind up getting ballots and casting them.
But I also think that this may have something to do with appeasing the very influential and powerful progressive hard left of the party. They need that wing of the party to kind of stay together with their coalition. And I think this may have something to do with just, giving a sop to those people who just believe in wide open borders, that, we should share everything with the world. And, they have this sort of ideology.
Well, I agree with that, Todd. I think there is some of that. But I also think most of those people, the ideological drive is not just that there shouldn't be borders, there shouldn't be countries, there should just be this one big planet and everybody can freely move wherever they want. It's also tied into this agenda, which is getting rid of this country specifically and doing that through voting or whatever other means are available to them. So when you look at this problem of people getting in, people being disseminated nationwide, Todd, one of the other concerns, of course, is that we are in the midst of a pandemic. What has your experience been? What's the data suggesting is the magnitude of the problem of people getting in our country in this fashion who actually have COVID-19 and are not being diagnosed, let alone treated for it, and sent hither and yon in a manner that can only conduce to further intensifying the pandemic, would it not?
Yeah, well, there are two things happening. One, I can report happily that at least in the experience that I saw, the people I interviewed, and what I came away with in the Del Rio sector along the Texas-Mexico border is that now, in recent weeks, the federal government has been able to bring in a private contractor to the Border Patrol facilities in this sector, and they're giving them all COVID tests several times before they are allowed to get on the buses. So these ones that are getting on the buses just in the last couple of weeks have been COVID tested. I'm not sure what they're doing with the positives, probably holding them back. But that's happening at least here. But on the other hand,
I sure hope so.
Yeah. But on the other hand, there are a lot of gotaways, thousands of gotaways that are getting right through Border Patrol and running into the interior of obviously not being tested at all. And lots of those folks are going to have COVID for sure.
And presumably find their way into various parts of the country as well. Just very quickly, Todd, we got less than a minute. What were you seeing on the other side of the border in terms of the presence and the activities of the cartels that are benefiting so massively from all of this?
Well, that's interesting because in this particular, I had a piece up yesterday about the Del Rio sector and how immigrants are shopping for border crossings, and they hop from one town to the other, to the other, to the other until they can find one. And they're coming to the Del Rio sector because this area, the cartel there is still mainly interested just in drug trafficking, not in people moving. So all the migrants that I interviewed on the Mexican side are crossing themselves over without a coyote, without the cartel. It's very unusual, but that's why they're going to this sector, because it's a little safer and frankly cheaper. They don't have to pay anybody to cross, and they get
on the bus service is good. Needless to say, Todd, we got to leave it at that. Thank you for this terrific reporting you're doing, as well as all of the other great work that you and your colleagues at the Center for Immigration Studies perform on this vital topic of the border crisis and what we must do about it. I know you keep up the good work, and I hope you'll be back with us again very soon. Meantime, God bless you.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to a man I have been privileged to interact with of late and regard as a national treasure, not least for the work that he does every day in this medium. He is the president and CEO of Financial Issues Stewardship Ministries and is a nationally syndicated radio and TV host of Financial Issues. His name, of course, is Dan Celia, a good friend, greatly admired colleague, and always welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Dan, it's good to have you back.
Frank, it is great to be back, and sure appreciate your efforts, what you do, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
Thank you, and vice versa. Dan, there's an important initiative that's just getting underway today from a coalition that I'm proud to be part of called the Back to Neutral Coalition. They're launching a website called StopCorporateTyranny.org. I talk a little bit about it in my commentary, but you're a man who both comes from Wall Street and covers it relentlessly. And from the perspective of a pro-American, freedom-loving, Constitution-respecting individual, you've been watching, and I know horrified, as have been, I think, probably more and more of us, by what's happening to our country across the broad spectrum of our institutions. But particularly, Dan, I'd be interested in your thoughts about what's going on in corporate boardrooms in regards to sort of the leftist takeover, woke capitalism, as Steve Sukup calls it. Your thoughts on all of that, and how serious a problem is it?
Well, I think StopCorporateTyranny.org is very exciting. I'm excited to see that and what they're trying to do. And, you know, Frank, no one over the last 30 years, no one that I know of, has spoke to more corporate executives and corporate CEOs about getting in the neutral zone than I have. Now, I've done it from a different perspective, but I've had a chance to say, look, I'm not asking you to support my organization or my things. I'm just asking you to stay neutral. Don't go to the left. Don't go to the right. Just stay neutral. Do your job. Flip hamburgers, build cars, or whatever it is you're to do.
Return shareholder value, among other things.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So
when you ask the question, what's going on in corporate boardrooms? Boy, that is a real good question, Frank. It is mind-boggling to me that we can have an entire corporate boardroom of any corporation that is this buying into this dictatorship of this woke capitalism that BlackRock and Larry Fink seem to love so much, when their job, when the CEO's job, as far as I know, is to add value to their stockholders, to do whatever it is they do, to make sure there's feet walking through their stores, to make sure there are enough people flipping hamburgers, make sure there's manufacturing going on as it should be, to add value to the bottom line of their stock. Their political views should have nothing to do with anything in the corporate world. And the thing I love about StopCorporateTyranny.org, the thing I love about it is they're doing what I've been doing for 30 years, telling corporate America to just stay neutral. We're not imposing our viewpoints, our values, our ideology upon your far left ideology or whatever it might be. We're just asking you to do what you're getting paid millions of dollars to do, what you're supposed to do for your shareholders.
Dan, as you say, this is in such stark contrast to the insistence of people like Larry Fink. He's not the only one, but he happens to be, I can't kind of think, the 8,000-pound gorilla in this mix, with his environment, social justice, governance agenda. And oh, by the way, simultaneously and bizarrely, his hard push to get people to invest in a nation and corporations that have no regard for any of that in communist China. This is a radical leftist agenda that is being imposed by the others, which brings me to, you know, sort of the larger point. When people insist that stakeholder capitalism is now what matters, not shareholder capitalism, is there really such a thing, Dan Celia? I mean, is that not the antithesis of capitalism at the end of the day?
Yeah, it is. And stakeholder capitalism doesn't exist. I mean, they're talking about something that shouldn't exist. It's not about that. It is about the shareholders. You can't be a publicly traded company. You can't be a company that is working for the public, the masses, all people across the board that might have interest in your shopping at Walmart or buying cars or whatever it might be. You can't infuse your thoughts, ideology, or anything else you want to try to put in to the agenda into what is not your job, what you shouldn't be doing. It's not what you're about. Leave that to the advocate groups on the left and on the right. Leave it to individuals to decide what they want to do in regards to that. It has a little, if little, nothing to do with the fact that your job is to build a cost-effective, efficient, well-oiled machine of a car or whatever it is you're doing. That's your job. Your job is to bring value to people, maximize return. Right, exactly. And it is insanity that we would even have an organization like, although I love it, of Stop Corporate Tyranny. I mean, it's almost like, what? Why would we have to have that? Because that's the world in which we live.
It's mutated. Yeah, the fundamental transformation, as Barack Obama used to call it. So when you look at all of this, Dan, I'm interested in a couple of examples of how this is turning in practice into a really formidable weapon for these radical leftists to not just transform corporate boardrooms and America, for that matter, but our country more broadly. Let's talk about two examples, if we could. One is Georgia. As we speak, and you know so well, Dan, efforts are being made at long last by the Georgia state legislature and the governor to remedy some of the abuses of the electoral process that took place during the 2020 elections. And sadly, they didn't get around to doing this sooner, but they have now. They've enacted legislation. The governor signed it into law. And the, you know, left is going nuts about it and is working now, I believe, with corporate entities, both in Georgia and elsewhere, to try to blackmail, bludgeon, coerce, and otherwise, you know, reverse this legislative initiative that seems to me both needed and long overdue. What are your thoughts about this as an example of this kind of, corporate tyranny in operation?
Well, I think it's a great example of what corporate America in so many ways, not all corporations, but so many of them now, you know, they want unity, but yet we have to continue to divide. In other words, we want unity, but we can't have unity because a particular group needs to have a certain set of rules and regulations that is good for them and not good for maybe another group of people. There is constantly, when we graduate students now, we speak about unity in America at the very same time that they have separate graduations for certain classes of people.
Or ethnicities or races or what have you.
Right, exactly. So there is no unity. And now we've got corporate America trying to do the same, trying to, they're dividing. Now they're doing something that is totally against their values, not values from a moral perspective, but the corporate values that they've laid out for their employees that are related to the work that they do, not related to social, what they perceive as social correctness, as political correctness. It's not about that for corporate America, and it shouldn't be. If they're going to separate that, then they've got to begin to have set aside jobs and areas in their company that are set aside for Black Americans, that are set aside for Asian Americans, that are set aside for white Americans, that are set aside for Hispanic Americans. Then let's divide jobs and make sure that you have 30 Hispanic Americans and 30 white Americans. Yes, they're doing two different jobs, but the 30 white Americans shouldn't be 35 or 40. It should stay 30 because that's what's fair and equitable. And they're not thinking about the population, and the percentages of population. This is everything that is going on right now, even in corporate America, is the will of the minority of people. I'm not saying that the minority of people don't have the right to have a will for certain things, but at the same time, we can't have no voter rules and regulations when 75% of American people think it's right. 76% of American people, according to Rasmussen, thinks wants to defend the Second Amendment. Yet we have a minority of people and a minority of corporate America against it. It's not a political issue.
Vociferally.
75% of the people are against it.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan, we're out of time long before we've run out of things to talk with you about. I wanted to visit with you about China and what it's doing to impose on corporations like H&M its agenda as well. But that will be for another day, I hope very soon. In the meantime, Dan, thank you for the incredible clarity you bring to these things and for your interest in and your support for this important new Stop CorporateTyranny.org initiative. We'll look forward to talking with you further about it as well in the near future. Meantime, Godspeed, and thanks for what you do at Financial Issues. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, Victoria Coates. We'll talk with her about the Middle East and more next.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're glad to have with us another of our distinguished colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, a senior fellow by the name of Dr. Victoria Coates. She has of late been in high office in the United States government, including in the past as a national security advisor to Senator Ted Cruz, and more recently as a deputy national security advisor to President Donald Trump. Victoria, I just wanted to tell you a piece that we've just taped with Grant Newsom that will run immediately after this segment. He talks about rather shocking, I think, probably to most Americans' ears, and that is that the experience in Alaska recently, in which several senior American officials were humiliated by several Chinese diplomats, is evidence in Grant's estimation of utter contempt for the United States under the Biden administration by the Chinese Communist Party. And I wanted to see if you agreed with that assessment, that they think of us as running dogs, as he put it, and to just work through a little bit what that might mean in terms of not just our diplomatic relations, but the possibility of a miscalculation, perhaps like that Nikita Khrushchev engaged in when he took the measure of John F. Kennedy at a summit meeting between the two and considered him weak and exploitable, and that precipitated, in short order, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Can you talk us through that?
Well, I think it's certainly a very thought-provoking analogy. I would always defer to Grant on issues related to China, but I can't see anything there that I would disagree with. I think Anchorage was probably a more momentous moment than maybe we realized as it was happening. And, you know, the administration sort of dismissing it as a testy press conference, but it was a lot more of that. As you said, I mean, they were taking the measure of Secretary Blinken and National Security Advisor Sullivan. And I think they came to the conclusion that these were not people they needed to take particularly seriously. And, you know, from my perspective, looking at Middle East issues, the fact that, one of their top diplomats went straight to Tehran to ink the 25-year deal with Iran was a very pointed response to that. That they don't care about our sanctions anymore. They are going to partner with the Iranians on fossil fuels. And I think, you know, for this administration, you know, with climate being their top priority, for, you know, for China to be so obviously flouting that priority, you know, with one of our primary adversaries, I think it tells you everything you need to know.
It sure does. When you look at all of this, Victoria, the stage, it would seem, is set for more aggressive behavior, possibly in the Middle East, certainly, I fear, in East Asia. Let's talk, though, about Iran, because you're, as we speak, shortly to conduct a webinar on the subject of American policy towards Iran with Fred Flights, the president of the Center for Security Policy, and our colleague David Wormser, one of our senior directors. As it happens, by the time this program airs, people will be able to see the video of that webinar at securefreedom.org. But give us some highlights of what you think needs to be considered as we're watching this, contemptible administration behaving in a manner that surely is intensifying that attitude towards them, not only in Beijing, but in Tehran as well.
Right. I mean, I appreciate your mentioning the webinar. I wish we were going to be talking about something a little bit different, because it's pretty depressing at this point. We're about 70 days into the administration, and you know, there was some ambiguity coming in about how they were going to approach Iran. You know, there were encouraging words from Secretary Blinken that he wanted some Iran hawks on his staff to provide alternative viewpoints. None of that has taken place. And I think what we have seen is a very clear indication that they want back into the deal on any terms. The deal itself is the goal. And, you know, it's a position I've long held, that those who place all of their stock in multinational organizations and diplomacy at all costs, the JCPOA, the Iran deal, was in and of itself a sort of a monument to that. Negotiated with the European Union. So it's like Paris. It doesn't matter what's in the deal. It's the fact of the deal that they want to get back into. So, you know, we've seen from very early days, removing the Houthi from the FTO list, freezing the arms sales to Saudi Arabia and UAE, relaxing the restrictions on the movements of Iranian quote-unquote diplomats coming over to the United Nations. And now, you know, we read in Politico that they're trying to figure out how they're going to relax sanctions before the Iranians return to compliance with the JCPOA.
One might add, by the way, to that list, encouraging South Korea to turn over to the Iranians some billions of dollars as well. I mean, this is right out of the playbook of the previous administration with respect to Iran, showering it with tens of billions of dollars, some of it in cash, no less. And Victoria, when you look at all of this, you're absolutely right. Of course, this is grim. And the response on the part of the Iranians has been even more so. The spittle that is now being placed firmly on Joe Biden's face, I believe, by the mullahs is something that, even if you're not an admirer of this particular president, it is such a signal of the low regard and lack of concern about our country at the moment, that coming on the heels of what we just heard about with respect to the Chinese, I think should offend everybody and urge, you know, cause us to urge corrective action here. But is there any sign, as far as you can tell from the Biden team, that it is reconsidering the trajectory that you've just described that it's on with respect to the mullahs?
Unfortunately not. And to your point about the pallets of cash from the Obama administration, bear in mind the person who's now sitting in my seat in the EEOB is Brett McGurk, who's the one who flew the cash over. So they've got the whole team in place to recreate that pattern. And, you know, no, they seem to be doubling down on it. You know, the human rights report that just came out in the State Department yesterday cuts by 2/3 the estimated people killed in the 2019 protests from over 1,000 to about 300. They changed that line in the report.
On the basis of some factual evidence that they had been overstating it in the past? Or do you think this is just another sop to the Iranians?
I think it's another sop to the Iranians. A reporter quite heroically asked them about it yesterday at the daily briefing, and they had no answer. They said, oh, we'll have to get back to you on that.
Yeah, we'll circle back.
Right. we'll be circling back on that.
Now, again, Victoria,
1,000 people we were pretending weren't killed.
You have operated, as I said, at high levels of the United States governments for some time, legislative branch as well as in the executive. One of the things that, is so distressing about all of this is not just that our country is being demeaned and diminished, but that it, as Grant Newsom was suggesting, almost certainly going to translate into increased aggressiveness against our vital interests and those of our friends and allies on the part of these thugs who sense our weakness and are incentivized to exploit it. Is that how you see it in the Middle East as well as Asia?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, an episode from the news this week that may seem unrelated is the getting stuck of the Ever Given, the huge container vessel in the Suez Canal. And my colleague, Rob Greenway, and I have a piece in Bloomberg Opinion today about how this needs to serve as a wake-up call because Iran is watching. They saw how that almost paralyzed the world economically.
Did paralyze it for a time.
Right, for 6 days. And they have shown themselves very willing to ignore what you might call the norms of global shipping. They turn off their GPS. Their ships aren't properly maintained. They will attack commercial shipping.
They've dumped oil off the coast of Israel as well. No, and Victoria, this is such an important point because to the extent that they may not even want to leave the neighborhood, they could do that at any moment in the Strait of Hormuz, right offshore.
Well, and Bab al-Mandab, and then the Suez. I mean, these three unbelievably narrow, fragile choke points in the Middle East.
Yeah, and the trouble for the rest of us is that, of course, that would translate into huge economic repercussions. Is a protection against that, at least in the Strait of Hormuz, that that's the channel through which they move their oil to their newfound sponsor, patron, ally, China?
Yes, although, you know, the construction of the new port at Chandahar gives them an out from the Strait of Hormuz. You know, it's a different calculus for that strait than we've had in the past because we are not dependent on the energy stream coming out of there anymore, or we haven't been if we retain our energy dominance. And one other point, a slightly more hopeful that I'd make is that we have defenders in Congress. There are very strong senators. Senator Cruz, obviously, Senator Hagerty is a great new voice on this. Senator Cotton are all very strongly standing up against the administration and trying to put some protections in place vis-a-vis Iran. And that is, in some ways, our last defense.
Well, it's vital. They are all in the minority, however, which is a problem on a whole host of issues, as you know so well. Victoria Coates, thank you for your time today. Good luck with the webinar, and we look forward to talking with you about it next week after the dust settles. And hopefully we have some further perspective on what is afoot in the Middle East on so many of these fronts. Thank you for the work you're doing, among other places, at the Center for Security Policy. We appreciate it. Next up, we will speak with Grant Newsom.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a man who, in addition to serving his country with great distinction in uniform, also was a foreign service officer and has been a businessman in the Western Pacific for quite a number of years. He is these days a research fellow for the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, and I'm very pleased to say a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy as well. His name, Grant Newsom, is familiar to anyone who's tracking issues of interest to us in the Western Pacific, and we're always delighted to have him here as a guest. Colonel, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to talk with you about an important piece that you ran in End Magazine recently, Sam Faddis's terrific online resource under the heading, "Did China Just Treat Us Like the Running Dogs They Believe We Are?" That's a term that some of us are familiar with, but probably not all. Run that by us, what that means in the Chinese lexicon, and what it says about how they're viewing the United States at the moment?
It's a statement of just immense contempt. You know, that's probably the easiest way to look at it. If you think of a dog picking up scraps from the master's table, you know, completely subservient. And that's what they've got in mind.
And in a society that doesn't have much use for dogs, other than perhaps as an edible consumption item, right?
That's the thing to remember. It is just as contemptuous as it can get. And that is what you saw on display in Alaska,
where two senior Chinese diplomats met with two senior American officials, Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, and Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor to the President. And contempt would seem to me pretty clearly the leitmotif of the Chinese extended remarks, not just the content of the remarks, but the fact that they went on for about five times as long as they were supposed to in front of the press. When you understand Eastern societies as you do, the loss of face that entailed at the hands of the Chinese communists is something that we may not adequately understand, Grant. Can you give us a sense of what it means geopolitically in the region, as well as what it meant on the spot?
It meant that the Chinese could demonstrate to the public, to the entire world, since the press was there, that what they have no use for the United States. They, as I said earlier, the absolute contempt they have. They berated the two American officials, three actually. A fellow named Kurt Campbell was there as well. Absolutely berated them. They denigrated the U.S. system. They told the Americans they had no right to talk about human rights or to criticize the Chinese at all. And this is a sign throughout Asia, and I would suggest worldwide, of the contempt the Chinese have for the U.S. side. But most importantly, it demonstrated that they're not afraid of the U.S., of this administration. And that's the particularly worrisome thing, is when you are not afraid of somebody, you act a certain way.
Yeah, it's nice to be respected, but at the very least, you want to be feared by ruthless thugs like these. And talk a little bit, if you would, Grant, about the degree to which this contempt is in part born of considerable experience with all of these individuals. And by the way, you know, the commander-in-chief, the man that they were representing at the time, Joe Biden. Familiarity breeds contempt, they say. Is that what's going on here in part? And talk a bit about the compromise of these individuals as well by the CCP.
Well, that's definitely part of it. The Chinese are familiar with these people. They've dealt with them before as government officials, but also as people looking to make some money from China, from their private business activities. And so it's not as if the Chinese just showed up in Alaska and adopted this strategy. They knew exactly what they were going to do. And as you mentioned, they have seen all of these people before. They have their number, and they don't respect them, and they think that they've got them. And that is not a healthy thing to have. And this should have all been expected. The administration should have known what was coming when they went to Alaska. Should have been no press there at all. And if the Chinese got out of hand, the meeting should have ended. If this had been the Trump administration and Mike Pompeo, that's what would have happened.
No question about it. Well, in the first instance, I don't think it would have happened because they were feared and I think probably respected as well. This brings us to the practical implications of not fearing the United States, having contempt for the administration. Talk about all of that, Grant, as the context in which we are witnessing the Chinese inexorably ratcheting up their ability to project power against, including, it seems, invading the island of Taiwan, or certainly some of its outer islands. You follow closely, as a former military man, what's called in the intelligence business indicators and warnings. What are we seeing at the moment in the way of INW, and how imminent might it be that the Chinese would actually act if they do not feel deterred by the United States to accomplish something that they've had as a goal for many decades.
Well, that's a good way to look at it, because it's not just the case of the Chinese coming to Alaska to insult the Americans, but rather it is a test of the Americans to see how much nerve they've got and whether they will take on the Chinese aggression in the region and globally. What you're seeing is just stepped up Chinese pressure in the East China Sea against Japanese territory. Throughout the South China Sea, they're just gradually and inexorably locking it up with a military presence, paramilitary presence, fishing fleet presence, etc. And then you mentioned Taiwan, and Alaska needs to be viewed as sort of a forerunner for Taiwan. And it's testing the U.S. China does have the capability to launch a full-scale assault on Taiwan if they want, and they may think that they have a pretty good chance of success. They've built up this capability over 50 years, but it's really over the last 10, 20 that it has really gotten alarming and capable to the point that they could have a good go at Taiwan. And the effect of Taiwan coming under Chinese control is hard to imagine. It would demolish U.S. defenses in Asia, and it would also undercut any respect anybody has for us. And for so this, you'd feel this worldwide as well. And that's what the Chinese are about. It's what they've got in mind. They said they're going to do it, and they're going to do it unless they're stopped.
I couldn't agree more with your assessment of this, and it's always worrying when that's so, because I kind of hoped you would say, well, it's not that bad, but it seems every bit as that bad. Specifically, Grant, what I guess I'm interested in is, to what extent have the Chinese put into place, whether it's the railroad lines they've run to the coast, or whether it's the ballistic missile emplacements that are now arrayed against Taiwan, or whether it's these new heliports that apparently are being built, vast new facilities or augmented facilities, that would enable the Chinese to essentially launch an attack against Taiwan with very little forewarning to us or advance notice that it's coming. Is that something that you're also seeing them put into place?
Yes, there's no good news there either. Chinese have put in all the pieces that you need to launch an attack, and a short notice, almost no notice attack, in fact, against Taiwan. You've described some of those pieces, which is the infrastructure that lets you move troops and equipment and weaponry to the coast, get it onto ships, get it ashore. Long-range missiles, they've got thousands of those as well. And they've got a huge conventional force of naval ships, amphibious transport ships, and aircraft. In recent days, they have actually been circling the island of Taiwan, have been operating on the eastern side and the western side with bigger air forces than they ever have. It's probably just a test at this point, or psychological intimidation, but it is headed in the wrong direction, and sooner than anybody thinks.
And the problem with these tests is that we tend to become inured to them doing it. And that further diminishes perhaps our situational awareness about what actually is in the works. And the two things occur, and we don't have a whole lot of time. Grant, in fact, we don't have any time at all. We're going to have to come back to you very soon. There's much more to talk about this. We appreciate very much your time today and the great work that you do with us at the Center for Security Policy and at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. Thank you for your cumulative service to our country and that you're rendering as we speak. Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.